Welcome to the third podcast in the Freshfields International Arbitration Group series. Today's podcast is on developments in investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS. I'm Alex Wilbram, counsel in the International Arbitration Group based in Washington, D.C. I specialize in commercial and bilateral investment treaty disputes involving the Americas, particularly Latin America. With me today are Giselle Stevens-Chu, who's counsel in our Paris office, and Jack Tashsenyo, who's counsel in our Tokyo office. Giselle specializes in investment treaty and commercial arbitrations in the European area and also in Africa. Jack works on commercial and treaty arbitrations involving Japan, China, and the rest of Asia. Today we'll be talking about the backlash against ISDS. This has arisen in recent years because of a perceived unfairness that is inherent in the system, or is perceived to be inherent in the system, by its critics. ISDS has developed at a fast pace over the last 30 years, and that naturally has created reactions among users, the users being, of course, countries and investors. There is concern among countries and certain NGOs about the nature of ISDS. It's characterized by those critical of the system as one which involves secret tribunals who encroach on matters of public policy because they make decisions behind closed doors, or at least that is what is said about the system. And these decisions affect states' rights to regulate on important issues such as tax or the environment and so on and so forth. There is also concern about the profile of arbitrators who sit on tribunals. Arbitrators are from a small selective group of specialists who have come, in the eyes of those who are critical of the system at any rate, to dictate how the whole system of international law works. Critics of the system believe that this is something that should be changed, and there are various proposals around for how this might happen that have been made at a government level or among international organizations. There is also a counter-reaction to this criticism by those who believe the system is good, that it does work, and that it has built a system over the last 30 years that is effective in protecting investors' rights and indeed in protecting states and providing access to justice. We'll also be talking about the populist reaction against ISDS. This has happened, for example, among left-wing governments in Latin America and has seen the denunciation of various treaties and the Washington Convention by certain left-wing governments. Perhaps more surprisingly, there's also been a counter-reaction from the populist right, particularly during the Trump regime, with the antagonism that has been shown by the Trump regime towards trade agreements. And inside trade agreements like NAFTA, a key element of those agreements is investor-state arbitration. And the new USMCA is one of the features that we'll be talking about of this move against arbitration, or move to restrict arbitration. So we'll be looking at various responses to these concerns. Let's start with Europe, and with that I'll hand over to Giselle, who will be talking about developments in the European area.
Thank you, Alex. The European position on the ISDS debate stems essentially from two concerns. There are concerns with ISDS as a system, and those concerns are encapsulated quite clearly in the EU's submission to the UNCITRAL Working Group 3 in 2017 in the context of discussions on reforms of the investor-state dispute settlement system. And criticisms ranged from, you know, the ad hoc nature of the system, resulting in a lack of consistency and predictability, the absence of an effective appeal mechanism, and the nature of the appointments process. And the EU also emphasized the public law dimension of BITs and the impact that can have on the state's sovereign right to regulate. And those concerns have led the EU as a whole and European member states to advocate a permanent standing body with full-time and tenured adjudicators, drawing on mechanisms such as those in existence in the human rights international system and the WTO system. The second concern, which is obviously more specific to Europe, is that the ISDS system as presently conceived is incompatible with European treaties and European Union law, at least insofar as it concerns intra-EU bits. There's also a potential debate with respect to the Energy Charter Treaty, to which the European Union is a member. And that particular concern is well encapsulated in the European Court of Justice's judgment in the ACMEA case, which was issued last year. And so those concerns have led, most recently, EU member states and the Commission to intensify their efforts to replace ISDS with an investment court system, which, of course, has yet to be properly established, and which raises many questions as to how it will be constituted and how it will function. But nonetheless, member states are pushing ahead with efforts to promote this system. There was a political declaration in January this year from EU member states in the wake of the ACMEA judgment, signalling that steps would be taken to terminate all intra-EU bits, and new treaties are envisaged to contain provision to submit disputes to permanent dispute settlement tribunals, as can be seen, for example, in CETA, the multilateral treaty between the EU and Canada, as well as new treaties concluded by the EU with Singapore, Mexico, and Vietnam. It's also reflected in the fairly recently published Dutch model bit, which also envisages disputes to be submitted to a permanent investment court. The other notable trend in European treaty making at present is concerted desire to balance more equitably, one might say, the rights and obligations of states and investors, and to promote sustainable investment. The European Union member states are deploying various tools in order to achieve these objectives. For example, referring again to the Dutch model bit, it provides that there can be no more investments by mailbox companies. To qualify, investors must have substantial business activities in their home state, and that potentially a significant restriction to the ability to bring investment claims under future Dutch BITs. But there's also the Dutch model bit also envisages changes to the scope of substantive treaty protections with much more nuanced definitions, for example, of fair and equitable treatment, as well as expropriation, a greater emphasis on the right of contracting states to regulate to achieve so-called legitimate policy objectives, as well as carve-outs for certain taxation measures. Indeed, the Dutch BIT even contemplates the possibility of claims against the investor in their home state if the investment were to cause damage, personal injury, or loss of life. Now, obviously, there's a big question as to how that provision will be put into effect in practice. But nonetheless, it's a provision that exists in the Dutch model bit. And then looking at other treaties, there are increasingly references to investments needing to abide by human rights or social or environmental norms, as, for example, reflected by the preamble to the CETA. So that's the current state of play in Europe. I would now pass on to Jack to give us an overview of the position which Asian states are taking on ISDS reform.
Thanks, Giselle. So a lot of the same concerns that you've just outlined are driving the criticisms of ISDS here in Asia as well. And many Asian states are taking a leading role in seeking reform of the ISDS system, similarly to what you're seeing in Europe. Some of them, like Indonesia and India, for example, have taken their criticism to the level of terminating existing bits, and they're seeking to replace them with new treaties that reflect the answer to some of these concerns about ISDS. And New Zealand, meanwhile, signed the CPTPP investment treaty along with many Asian states in 2018. This was after the U.S. pulled out of the original TPP version of that treaty. But New Zealand did so in conjunction with executing a series of side letters with several other CPTPP states that excluded or limited the use of ISDS as between them. Other Asian states like Vietnam, as you mentioned, are supporting the EU's efforts to create a standing ISDS court, as reflected in the new EU-Vietnam agreement, which would refer disputes to such a court. But Japan, meanwhile, has been resisting a change like that, as reflected in its continuing negotiations with the EU over the dispute provisions of the otherwise agreed EU-Japan Economic Partnership Agreement. So the Asian states' concerns are captured in their comments to UNCITRAL Working Group 3, which was formed to address potential reform of the ISDS system arising from all these criticisms that have been coming out in the last few years. Three common concerns that the Asian states are voicing are the consistency and predictability of arbitral awards, the professionalism of arbitrators, and the rise of third-party funding. So on the first one, China, for example, is concerned that ISDS awards lack stability and predictability. It's supporting a permanent ISDS appeal mechanism, perhaps using the WTO system as a model. And Thailand is also concerned with predictability in awards and has recommended that this be achieved through a joint interpretation mechanism that would create consistency in arbitral awards. Indonesia is another Asian state that has voiced this similar concern and has called for methods to address the inconsistency of awards, and in fact has gone so far as saying that maintaining the current ISDS system simply is not an option. Many Asian states have also expressed concern with the professionalism and independence of arbitrators. This has become a big issue in the criticisms of ISDS. And Korea, China, Thailand, and Indonesia, for example, have all called for the adoption of a code of conduct for arbitrators. And in fact, such a code of conduct has been included in the CPTPP. As for third-party funding of disputes, this has become a big issue in Asia in recent years after Singapore and Hong Kong formally made third-party litigation funding legal, which has led to increased concerns among the Asian states about this practice. Korea, for example, has voiced its concern that third-party funding could lead to hidden conflicts of interest, where there might be a connection between the arbitrators and the funders, and also think that it may cause more frivolous claims to be brought. Query whether that is actually a likely outcome of third-party funding. Korea has sought rules requiring the disclosure of the identity of any third-party funders and possibly even the terms of the third-party funding agreements. And China has expressed similar concerns, as have other Asian states. Japan, meanwhile, in addition to the ongoing negotiations with Europe, they're recognizing their neighbors' concerns about ISDS, but at least in their comments to Working Group 3, they've taken the position of, rather than providing what they think the resolution of those concerns should be, they've been focusing on the suggestion of creating a suite of possible solutions so that states would be able to select the solution that they like when drafting their treaties so that they can maintain flexibility in doing so. So what will eventually come out of the working group's efforts and how these Asian states will approach ISDS in the future remains to be seen. But recently, we've seen the execution of the Indonesia-Australia Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, which was signed earlier this year, and this might provide a glimpse of the likely future, at least here in Asia. It includes an annex providing for an arbitrator code of conduct, like I mentioned, has been a concern, and as is included with the CPTPP. And it also excludes specifically frivolous or meritless claims from ISDS. And it requires consultation and conciliation, which is a topic I'll discuss more in a minute. So with that quick overview of what's happening here in Asia, let me hand back to Alex to tell us what's been happening in the Americas.
Thank you, Jack. Well, the story of the Americas in recent years has been one of denunciation and renegotiation, both north and south. Starting with the north, we've had the renegotiation of NAFTA, leading to the conclusion of the U.S. United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. That has seen a big change in investor-state arbitration, because from the time that this agreement comes into force, there is going to be no investor-state arbitration between the United States and Canada. Investors from the United States and from Canada with claims against either of those countries will need to go to the local courts. The USMCA does, however, retain the ability to use international investor-state arbitration in Mexico-US disputes, but has significantly curtailed the level of protections and the types of claims that can be brought. It really is now limited to claims that are centre on expropriation, and that excludes indirect expropriation. What we've lost is the ability to bring claims for fair and equitable treatment that were commonly used in NAFTA. This will mean, I think, a very significant change, because a lot of the types of disputes that we were seeing under the NAFTA agreement were regulatory disputes where precisely the clauses of treaties that parties were relying on were concepts such as fair and equitable treatment, the ways in which the claims were based upon the ways in which governments were changing regulatory regimes in a way that was unfair and inequitable. There was a relatively small amount of actual direct expropriations. If anything, claims would be for indirect expropriation, often as an alternative claim based on some kind of unfair and inequitable treatment. So I think there will be a very significant change in the types of claims that can be brought in US-Mexico international arbitrations, and that is going to significantly affect the ways investors think about protecting their rights going forwards. There is a 3-year sunset period for these treaties, for existing claims under NAFTA, so that will allow parties for the next 3 years to bring claims that are already in existence if they feel that they need to. But after that, there is going to be a significant sea change. It's the one point of seeming encroachment and common ground between Democrats and Republicans, both of which generally disagree with, dislike trade agreements. And a key feature that has been criticized is investor-state arbitration. Moving to the South and South America, we've seen regimes on the left from Venezuela and from Bolivia and from Ecuador denouncing the Washington Convention, ICSID, International Center for Investment Disputes. They've also found that by denouncing ICSID, that did not immediately end the ability of investors to bring claims, because, of course, many of the treaties that they had concluded with different countries on a bilateral basis included long sunset periods. So the countries have moved to denounce the treaties, but even then, many years have to pass before claims can actually come to an end. One interesting feature of this process has been where Ecuador denounced all its treaties. Then there was a change in regime, and then the new government decided that it wanted to encourage investment, and so it has relatively recently declared that it wants to renegotiate new treaties to encourage investment back into Ecuador. So whether that becomes a trend remains to be seen. It is something that could very well happen, because countries that need investment may find that actually the investor-state disputes that were a feature of those treaties were perhaps a price worth paying. Now, with that, I will hand over to Giselle, who can tell us something about what's happening in Africa.
Thanks, Alex. So I think it's fair to say that Africa is a bit of a laboratory when it comes to investment treaties and treaty making. There's been a lot of effort in recent years across the continent, sort of as between individual states and also at the level of regional African organizations such as COMESA, ECOWAS, SADC, to develop investment treaties to bring them in line with recent trends in international law, including both trends in investment law, but also norms of soft law in the areas of human rights and sustainable development and environmental norms. And that has yielded some rather interesting efforts in relation to African BITs. One example in point is the Morocco-Nigeria BIT, which has made a considerable effort to adopt a lot of these trends by taking on board in the definition of investment the Cellini criteria, with a view to ensuring that any investment is designed to make an effective contribution to the economy of the host state. And that BIT also seeks to impose obligations on investors rather than only on states, including compliance with environmental and social standards, as well as human rights norms. And the treaty further seeks to preserve some discretion in the state's ability to exercise its regulatory powers. So you can see how it's trying to balance the rights and obligations of investors and states in a manner that promotes the development of the host state. With respect to ISDS, the Moroccan-Nigeria bit adopts ISDS, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that generally across the continent, ISDS may be criticized, particularly when it comes to questions of the diversity of appointments on arbitral tribunals. But as an adjudicative mechanism, it's perhaps not rejected as strongly as in other parts of the world, perhaps due to a recognition, at least in Africa, of the huge difficulties inherent in establishing permanent international bodies, and perhaps also because historically African states have actually been at the forefront of developing and promoting investment law. But having said that, there is very much a feeling across the African region that new treaties must promote sustainable development and ensure an effective contribution to the economy of the host state. In this context, it's also worth noting the recent entry into force of the agreement establishing the African Continental Free Trade Area, which creates a very large pan-African trading bloc. It also places an emphasis on sustainable development and the need to balance rights and obligations and preserve states' right to regulate. It is still unclear whether that agreement will provide for ISDS, but we will see what happens on that front.
I think we have just a very short time to wrap things up and ask each of us what we think this all means for investors. So perhaps, Giselle, if I start with you.
In Africa and Europe, there is now a very strong emphasis in new treaties on the need to ensure that investments promote sustainable development and are in line with human rights, social norms, and environmental norms. So I think on that basis, we can expect the interpretation of substantive protections to evolve considerably, both in the context of disputes under new BITs, but also possibly in relation to disputes under existing treaties. In fact, we're already seeing states using these considerations in the context of pending investment disputes. So far, more as a shield than as a sword, as a basis to bring a counterclaim. But it's fair to say that the door is now more widely opened to states bringing counterclaims for breaches of such norms. And indeed, it's worth noting in this context, the case of Ubasa versus Argentina, in which the tribunal accepted jurisdiction over a counterclaim presented by Argentina based on the human right of access to water. That counterclaim was ultimately dismissed on the merits, but nonetheless, it is consistent with this trend of taking on board such concerns going forward in investment disputes.
Thank you, Giselle. From the perspective of Latin America, investors, I think, will need to look at different types of protection and multiple layers of protection. They need to think also about the contracts that they're signing with governments, looking at the concession agreements, making sure that they have arbitration clauses in those agreements that can be enforced, that are protected against local courts, or at least are seated, where the arbitration is seated in a jurisdiction that is suitable. They also need to think about the structuring of their investments so that perhaps they can go through countries not using non-European Union bilateral investment treaties, so that each investment should be properly thought out, and investors should not think that bilateral investment treaties and the regime that's existed for the last 20 years is going to be in place forever. Careful thought before investment is required. And with that, I'll hand over to Jack for his final thoughts.
The trend that we're seeing here is that investors can expect more ADR, more alternative dispute resolution methods, whether it be conciliation, which is essentially having to negotiate with the state for a period of time to try and resolve the dispute before an investor would be allowed to commence an arbitration, or mediation. And indeed, some of the Asian states are talking about making mediation mandatory or, as Thailand has suggested, promoting a hybrid of mediation and arbitration, which is something that's becoming a very popular topic of discussion out here in Asia. And of course, finally, there's the Singapore Mediation Convention, which is officially titled, and I had to write this down, the United Nations Convention on International Settlement Agreements Resulting from Mediation. And essentially what this does is does for a mediated settlement agreement what the New York Convention does for an arbitral award. It makes it enforceable in the courts of any of the signatories to the Singapore Convention. So this is likely, I think, to provide a further boost to the movement towards mediation and other ADR methods in ISDS throughout Asia and also probably around the world.
Thank you, Jack. Well, that brings us to an end of our third podcast in the International Arbitration Group podcast series. Many thanks to Giselle Stevens-Chu, Jack Terceño, and thank you from me, Alex Wilbram.